It feels like the applause is just getting worse the longer I'm here. Thank you. Thank you. Yes, you have not because you asked not. Garrison Keillor once said this. They say such nice things about people at their funeral. It makes me sad to think I'm going to miss mine by just a few days. Wouldn't you like to know what people are going to say about you when you're gone? Would you? Or, I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. So Alfred Nobel woke up in 1888 to realize that the world thought he was dead. Due to a reporting error, when his brother Ludwig died, they thought it was Albert. Now, let me tell you a little bit about Albert Nobel. He was a brilliant man. He held over 350 patents, and most of the patents that Alfred Nobel held were in the art of war. What he is most renowned for is the invention of dynamite, which made him a wealthy man. So when he opened up the paper that day to read about himself, this is what they called him: the merchant of death. And they said that Alfred Nobel had given his life to different ways to mutilate and kill. Can you imagine? If you were to choose a one-word legacy for Albert Nobel on that day, I think a good one would be war. Well, he wasn't satisfied with that. And so, in 1895, when he rewrote his last will and testament, he dedicated 90% of his wealth in adjusted dollars, that's $265 million, to five prizes in the world that would honor people for their the people that have conferred the greatest benefit on mankind. And he had prizes in all of these different areas, the most notable of which is the Nobel Peace Prize. Alfred Nobel was able to change his legacy, a legacy that still exists today. And if you were to give him a one-word legacy, what would it be now? He changed it from war to peace. Here's the truth that we can learn about the life of Alfred Nobel. Our legacy isn't what we want it to be. Our legacy is what we choose it to be. So here's my question I'm going to ask you today. What's the one word that defines you? If people were to look at you and give one word, what word would they use? What's the one word that you would like people to define you by? And there are all kinds of words that we could choose, like character, businesswoman. Some people look at you and go, fitness. Nobody's ever said that to me, but wealthy. Workaholic, family, driven, encourage. What's the word? What's the word you want it to be? I remember doing my very first funeral, and I didn't know anything about this person. It was somebody in my church, and their dad had died, so they sent me his obituary. And when I read this obituary, I go, oh my gosh, this person has accomplished so much. This is going to be incredible. He was a World War II fighter pilot. When he got out of the army, he was a test pilot who tested ejector seats. He was one of the very first pilots of the Goodyear blimp. And I'm thinking, I'm going to go to this funeral and it's just going to be packed and people are going to be honoring this person. And I showed up at the funeral and there's maybe 15 people. And his kids were there, but no one wanted to say anything. And one of them stood up, and I remember it to this day, the most encouraging, thing that this man said about his dad is how much dad liked his dogs. His one word legacy was not hero or fighter pilot. It was alcoholic. Now look, when we talk about setting a one word legacy for some people, that's like, oh my gosh, if it ended right now, I'd be so disappointed. Well, let me tell you something. If the merchant of death can change his one word legacy from war to peace, so can you. Okay, let me give you a quote. I'm living by this quote these days. Nito Cobain said this: your present circumstances don't determine where you can go. They merely determine where you start. Let's make today our starting point. Now, to figure out how we're going to do this, we're going to look into a life of a biblical character that if you were to give him a one-word title, it might be leadership. The one word that God used for him would be warrior. Now, when you think of somebody like that, you know, leader, warrior, what do you think? You know, strong, great personality, you know, blue jeans, blue shirt, right? Something like that. The way God defines a difference-making person is different than the way we define a difference-making person. And so today we're going to look into the life of a guy named Gideon and see what it takes to be a real, live leader, warrior, difference-making person for Jesus. If you have a Bible, open up to Judges chapter 6. This first verse just gives us context of what's happening in Jerusalem at this time. Again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. This is the way it worked, right? They'd follow God, they'd lose track of him, they'd do evil, they were in trouble, they'd call back to God. So they did evil, and this is what happened. For 7 years, he gave them into the hands of the Midianites. Because the power of Midian was so oppressive, the Israelites prepared shelters for themselves in mountain clefts, caves, and strongholds. Midian so impoverished the Israelites that they cried out to the Lord for help. Okay, here's what was happening. The Midianite army was 150,000 strong. Once a year, after harvest, they would attack the Israelites, and they'd steal all of their food. So this one moment in time, this one week in which they'd steal everything, impacted Israel for the entire year. So God says, I'm going to bring a judge to help get you out of this. Dude's name was Gideon. Judges 6:11. The angel of the Lord came, sat down under the oak in Ophrah that belonged to Joash the Abiezrite. Some really great baby names in there, okay? Where his son Gideon was threshing wheat in a wine press to keep it from the Midianites. Okay? You know what a wine press is? Okay, some older people will recognize this example. Remember the Lucy show? Where she's stomping grapes in a wine press. Anybody remember that? Well, this particular wine press that Gideon is must have had high walls, because what he's doing is he's threshing grain in this little enclosed area because he is so afraid that the Midianites are going to find him. This is the world-changing leader that we've been looking for. If Gideon's our example, then we got one first characteristic of a life-changing leader. Here we go. First characteristic of a high-powered, difference-making person is knee-knocking, teeth-chattering fear. Now, he's in this wine press, he's threshing grain, and God approaches him. Judges 6, verse 11, when the angel of the Lord appeared to Gideon, he said, the Lord is with you, mighty warrior. Now, when you think of a mighty warrior, what are your thoughts? He's sharpening his machete, right? Like he's dripping with sweat out of the gym. He's just exited the octagon. He's not nervously threshing grain in a wine press. Now, let me ask you a question. Is Gideon a mighty warrior in that moment? Absolutely he is. but not according to what other people would think, and not according to what the world would think, not even according, we'll find out later, what Gideon would think, but what God would think of him in that moment was that he's a mighty warrior, and here's what I need you to understand. If you want to make a difference in the world, that God sees qualities in you that you cannot even see yourself. You know, I'm guessing some of you walked in this morning and you didn't walk in here thinking, mighty warrior. You know, you slunk in, sat in the back. Sorry, Jeremy, not you specifically. I just happened to be looking this direction. And you're beaten up and you're tired and you've got something going on you can't solve. And the label you would give yourself is, oh, defeated one. Let me help you understand that God sees things inside of you that you do not see. Okay, let me give you a second characteristic of a high-powered, difference-making person. Paralyzing doubt. Okay, you good? You good on that one? Fantastic. We're all in. Gideon is approached by, it says, the angel of the Lord. There are a lot of scholars, biblical scholars, commentators who believe that this is actually Jesus himself. It's what's known as the pre-incarnate Christ, Christ before he actually came down to earth. Well, one way or another, he's approached by somebody who represents God. And this is his response. He's been called a mighty warrior by an angel or Jesus himself. And this is his response. Buoyed with that courage, he says, but sir, Gideon replied, if the Lord is with us, then why has all this happened to us? Where are all the wonders that our fathers told us about when they said, did not the Lord bring us up out of Egypt? But now the Lord has abandoned us and put us into the hand of Midian. Well said, mighty warrior. Well, you know, as long as you're here, I got some questions for you. Why has all this happened? What about all these wonders? Why have you abandoned us? God shows up and all of Gideon's worries and fears and doubts rise to the surface. And God's response, if you got a Bible, you gotta underline this. Judges 6:14. The Lord turned to him and he said, go in the strength that you have. Man, I've been holding on to that verse because I will be honest, I don't always feel like I have that much strength. But God's not telling me to go in the strength that Steve Stanfield has, Ricky has. He's telling me to go in the strength that he has given me. And I got you need to know that the strength you currently have is enough to do what God is calling you to do. Because what happens is we're asked to do something, and here's our response. I'm just so busy. Or what if they ask me a question and I can't answer it? Or I just haven't studied my Bible enough. Or my calendar, you see my calendar, man, it is so full. I have so many things to do. And same with Gideon. He says, go move, and we can come up with all these reasons and all these excuses why we can't do that thing. We can't reach out to that person. We can't join that ministry. We can't serve God in that way because of all this stuff. God says, go in the strength you have. What I'm calling you to do, you got enough to do it. Okay, third characteristic of high power, difference-making person. Do you have this? Crippling insecurity. All right, here's a character quality I think we all have. Most people have some insecurities. Some people have all the insecurities. We're somewhere in the middle of that. Okay, let me give you a couple of quotes. I think we're right in the middle of these two. Maxwell Maltz, author of Psycho-Cybernetics, estimates that 95% of people in our society have a strong sense of inadequacy. On the other hand, Ashley Brilliant wrote, All I ask of life is a constant and exaggerated sense of my own importance. We're right there, somewhere in the middle. We have all these insecurities, we want everybody to think we're important. Okay, let me tell you about one of the dumbest moves I ever made as a parent. You want to hear it? Yeah, you guys love it when I tell dumb stories about myself. Our pastor is such an idiot. I love him. I bought for our family a trampoline. You had a trampoline? You know what a terrible idea this is. Now, we made it out of the trampoline season without broken bones and lawsuits. Okay, so I think, David, you worked in insurance. Is buying a trampoline a good idea for a family? Now, having a trampoline is a tricky endeavor. So my daughter would love it if I went outside and I watched her jump on the trampoline. But like I said, it's tricky because, first off, under no circumstances can I ever avert my eyes. I have to watch every single jump. I can't glance at my phone. I get in trouble if I glance at my phone. If a meteor hits our house, I can only notice the meteor after I look at her flip. And secondly, what I say about the flip, right? I can't say under any circumstances that was better, because that implies that all of the other leaps were terrible. I can only say things like, that's fantastic. Wow, that's great. Man, are you an Olympian? You know, that kind of stuff. Now, in a completely separate point, let me just say this. After my message today, I don't want you to come up and say, well, that was better. Or, you're improving. In fact, I've written it down. This is what I want you to say. All your messages are fantastic, but this one is especially dynamic. But that's who we are, right? We have this sense of insecurity, and when God asks us to do something, that sense of insecurity dials up past 10. This is Gideon's response. Hey, mighty warrior, I'm about to send you in the game. He keeps going. But Lord, Gideon asked, how can I save Israel? My clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my family. And the Lord answered, I will be with you and will strike down all the Midianites together. And Gideon replied, if now I have found favor in your eyes, give me a sign that it is really you talking. Like, really? You're talking to an angel right now. What more do you want? So he asked for a sign. The first sign he gets is he brings God a piece of meat. I'm not going to read this to you. I'll just tell it to you. He brings him a piece of meat. God incinerates it on the spot. My wife did that with a pot roast once. You know why I said that? Do you see her here? Next, Gideon is most renowned for a fleece. Some people think a fleece is a step of faith. Well, this is what he said. A fleece is a little piece of sheepskin. He said, God, here's what I want. I'm going to put it out on the ground. And tonight I want it to be wet and I want the ground to be dry. And that happened. So he's convinced, right? No. Next night, does the exact opposite. Okay, I want the fleece to be dry, and I want the ground to be wet, because I think in Gideon's mind it's going, well, the first way, is that just the way nature works? I just don't know. This asking for a fleece, not a sign of faith. John Ortberg wrote this, the fleece was not a sign of Gideon's faith. God had already called him. Gideon knew what he was supposed to do. The fleece was an expression of resistance. God responds to the fleece not as an affirmation of Gideon's faith, but as a concession to Gideon's doubt. And here's what you and I need to understand. Your resume, your family history, however uninspiring, are enough for God to use you. So it doesn't matter about your divorce. It doesn't matter about your abortion, it doesn't matter about your addiction, all those things. God can heal you up from those and use you to do something great. In fact, I'll tell you this. I tell you this all the time. It may be the most difficult thing that you've walked through that opens the door for you to be able to make a difference in the lives of people, because it develops within you a compassion. Okay, got a fourth characteristic of a high power difference-making person: lack of adequate support. Okay, Judges 7 tells us the story of what happens. So God calls this mighty warrior, and he says, mighty warrior, I want you to get prepare your troops. So he calls all of Israel, and Gideon is able to gather 32,000, which is impressive, except you remember how many were in the Midianite army? 150,000. Not only that, but Midian had asked another country to join them, which had 50,000. It's 32,000 against 200,000. And so Gideon, of course, is freaking out. And God says, okay. He doesn't think, you know what, well, let's make the call again. Let's offer pizza this time. Okay, let's do that. He says, actually, the 32,000 is too many. So turn to your guys and say this. If anybody's scared, they can go home. You know how many go home? 22,000. He's down to 10,000. God looks at that and says, still too many. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to tell them all to go get a drink. We're going to all go down to the river. You're going to take a drink. And the ones that take a drink, by putting their face in and drinking like dogs, you can send them home. Who does that? But the ones that scoop up the water with their hand and drink it like this, you got to believe at that moment, Gideon is saying to these guys, drink with cup your hands, you filthy animals. What's wrong with you? Do you know how many people he ends up with? 300. 300? And here's the plan, okay? I want you to all have a torch, and I want you to all have a pot. These are going to be your weapons of war. And I want you to light the torch, and I want you to put the pot over it. In the middle of the night, we're going to go into the Midianite army, right in the middle of it. And then at this sound, I'm going to tell you to drop the pot and show the torch. Let's see what happens. They drop the pot, they show the torch, and the Midianite army thinks that they are under attack, and they start fighting each other. Here's the tally. I'll say this for the guys that made sure you watch Gladiator. You'll like this. 120,000 swordsmen had fallen that day. So one last lesson for you and I. If you feel like you don't have enough strength, supplies, or smarts to pull off your current task, then you are exactly where God wants you. So I got a checklist for you. Let's see how you're doing. Let's see if you're capable of being used by God. Do you have knee-knocking, teeth-chattering fear? Do you have paralyzing doubt? Do you have crippling insecurity? And are you inadequately supplied? You got all those things? Now, look, we started off this message talking about what is the one word that defines you, or what one word would you like to define you? And here's my word for you. You don't have enough ability to pull it off on your own. The only way you're going to pull this off and be remembered for this thing is if God is involved in your life. Because here's the reality. We make our biggest impact when we join God in what he's doing. Okay, I'm going to make a weird shift in this message. Because when we talk about the one word that defines you, there's a group of people that this means more to than other people. In fact, it is this group of people that is considered, as they're doing research these days, on unreached people groups, that this particular group of people is one of the most unreached people groups. In fact, the Billy Graham Association has come out with statistics that they believe that this is the most unreached people group, one of the most unreached people groups in the world. And do you know who that people group is? Have I got your attention? It's people who are 55 and older. They're called boomers. And by the way, if you're a boomer and somebody says, hey, boomer, that's not an encouraging word to you. Just FYI. And these are a group of people that when the world looks out, they discount their ability to make a difference in the world. And some of you are living that reality right now. Okay, I heard this. I've been dying to tell you this story. Chuck Swindoll, he was actually my first pastor. I worked there for 6 years. And he tells this story. I love it. Some older guy sent it to him. I'm 83 years old. I was in the McDonald's drive-thru this morning. I guess that's my 83-year-old voice. I was in the McDonald's drive-thru this morning. The young lady behind me leaned on her horn and started mouthing some ugly things because I was taking too long to place my order. So when I got to the first window, I paid for her order along with my own. The cashier must have told her what I'd done because as we moved up, she leaned out her window and she waved to me. She began mouthing, "Thank you, thank you," probably feeling embarrassed that I repaid her rudeness with kindness. When I got to the second window, I showed the server both receipts and I took her food too. Now she has to go back to the end of the queue and start all over again. Don't blow your horn at old people. We've been around for a long time. Don't you love that? We can't overlook this people group. I have a quote from Bob Beale in his book Decade by Decade, and he said this: the most productive decade of a person's life is their 60s. The second most productive decade of a person's life is their 70s. The third most productive is your 50s, and your 50s are just setting you up for your 60s. Now, let me tell you something. I was a pastor of a church for 25 years, and this is what would happen. People would, you define yourself and your church by your children, a lot of you. That's why you go where you go. And then your kids graduate, and these people have this thought of, do I really fit here anymore? And this was my response to those people, because I would hear from them, hey, what's this church got for me? What's this church got for me? And I'm thinking to myself, there's all kinds of places, just greet or work in the children's ministry. We have missions. Go on a mission trip. Just find something to do. And I kept hearing this in my mind whining. And I realized that wasn't a them problem. That was a me problem, because a lot of us in church look at people who are in this age like they're not committed anymore. And that isn't the truth at all. They're just differently committed, because you get to this place where your kids are out of the house and you got grandkids someplace, not as good a looking grandkids, but grandkids. And you have the freedom and you want to go there. Or some people have like a second home and they want to go there so they're not here as much. And we think that they're not committed. And I just want to tell you, we love that you are here. We love that you have a second home. I want to use your second home. Dave Rhodes is a pastor and he wrote it like this. What people in the fourth quarter are being told is, thank you for coming to our church. We appreciate your giving, but we don't need you anymore. So why don't you go play? This group of people, it's made up of people who have built businesses and taught thousands and made a difference. And maybe, just maybe, we can utilize them more than just volunteering in the nursery. So I'm part of this group called the Grand Plan. And the Grand Plan is a movement to help people in their fourth quarter find their ultimate contribution. And you can see it in the life of Albert Nobel. He figured out what he wanted his ultimate contribution to be. And that's what I want to challenge you to. Not only did he figure out what his contribution was, but he tied it to an artifact. He had the Nobel Peace Prize is what he remembered for. And as you think of that word, I want you to think of how you can tie it to an artifact. Let me just give you some examples, because it's a strange concept. Maybe it's hospitality. You're really hospitable. My friend Dave Rhodes, who I just quoted, he had a grandma that was her, what she wanted. She was really hospitable. And what they wish that she had done is created a cookbook with all the recipes as an artifact, right? Maybe you're a builder. Maybe you want to build things for your children and your grandchildren. But to create an artifact, an artifact can be like creating a trust, or it could be something really small. As I'm thinking back in my life, you guys know that my dad was an alcoholic, and for the first 12, 15, 20 years of my life, our relationship wasn't that great. But my dad created an artifact that was no more than maybe an inch and a half round. Let me tell you a little bit about my dad. Yeah. When I was in junior high, he found Jesus. And it had such a profound effect on him that he wanted to become a pastor. Now, one problem, he didn't like people. So if he could pastor dogs, he would have been great. But he loved studying, and he loved collecting theology books. And I remember one day he pulled me in to his office. And he said, "Jack, I just bought this." And it was like a paper brand. It's like a stamp. And you just push it in a book, and it raises, and you can read what it says. And it said, from the library of Jack Hawkins. His name and my name were the same, but we had different middle initials. And the middle initials were JWH, which was his middle initial, Wayne, and mine is Douglas. And he said, "Jack, I've just bought this stamp, and I'm stamping all these books. Because every time you read a theology book, I want you to remember me." It's an artifact I still have. So the last 3 years, I've been working on an artifact. The one word I would like to be known in my life is encouragement. I want to be the one that finds good in people around. I want to be the one who's on the lookout. I want to be the one that helps encourage people in their walk with Jesus. And so it's taken a little while. It's been a lot of work, but I have created an artifact. You want to see it. It's right here. It is my first book. And I feel like the applause should have been better for that. And you're part of my artifact, because if you've been at this church for any amount of time, the very first message series I did was called "Your Picture is on His Refrigerator." And it was my reflections of learning how to view my heavenly dad not as this exacting, critical father like my dad was in the earlier years of my life. And it's been a lifelong journey of mine to realize that my heavenly dad delights in me. And it's 10 messages, many of which I have given at Covenant Grove Church. And so one of the very first things I did, I got 3 copies, author copies, and the very first copy I got, I went to my garage, I found the paper stamp, and I stamped it with my dad's initials. Look, I want people to be encouraged. That's my goal. That's what I want my word to be. You know, when you're a pastor, there's lots of people to encourage. I can fly up here. I can encourage you. I can encourage people I'm counseling. I look, man, I'm at Olive Garden. I'm looking for a good waitress to encourage. Try to find them in the airport. There's one group of people that I cannot forget to encourage, that lots of pastors forget. And to my shame, there have been times I have forgotten as well. And it's my family. What I was most excited about writing this book for is at the beginning is an opportunity to give acknowledgments. 2 weeks ago, Grandma was at our house celebrating her 90th. And I wanted to have copies of the book, but I didn't have them in time to give them to them. And so each of my children, I pulled aside and I read the acknowledgments to them. I'll just read you a little bit. You can buy the book and read the rest. The first message I ever gave in big church was on Psalm 127 and 128 that starts with the line, "Unless the Lord builds a house," and ends with, "May he live to see his children's children." It has been my lifelong dream to exchange the dysfunction I grew up with for the function of my family.
I'm sure I didn't do it all right, but despite my familial flaws, I managed to get a front row seat to see four children come into my house and exceed my every expectation. I read that to them. I got some tears, mostly mine. And here's the question. What do you want to be remembered for? Encourager, generous, missionary, kindness, laughter, mentor, joy, compassion. I was talking to my friend Gary. He said the word honorable. I love that. Before I end, I'm over a little bit. Let me tell you, write this down. Read Judges 8, tells the end of Gideon's life. I would love to tell you that he left this great legacy. He did not. He married multiple women, which torpedoed his family. The nation that he led, as soon as he died, turned away, did not follow Jesus. In fact, they were so angry with Gideon that all of his family members were killed, minus one. He did leave an artifact, however. He collected gold earrings and created an image of a false god. Today you get to choose. Will you be like Alfred Nobel? Or will you be like Gideon? And where you are standing today does not determine where you're going, only where you start. Two questions. What's the one word you want people to remember you by? And two, what is God doing? And what's he calling you to do to join him in that? Let's pray. Just think about, what is the word? What's that word? It's hard. It took me a long time. But just think about that. Now think, how do you want to organize your life so that you can live out that one word definition of you? Lord God, there's lots of people, lots of different ages. I want to start by praying for those who are 55 and above. I want to tell you, you have not outlived your usefulness. God has gifted you and skilled you in many great and wonderful ways. As you begin this journey of finding out what that one word is and how are you going to use it, I pray, God, that you would empower these people. And I pray, God, that they would realize they don't have to be smart or talented or funny or adequately supplied. They just need you. And God, I pray that you would open up our eyes to what you're doing in the world so that we can join you in it. In your name we pray. Amen.